A63, number 24A.
Well, before we continue, I would like to make sure if I have expressed myself clearly or if you have difficulty in understanding how to interpret a text. I always say, don't read words, read a subject. Now, I don't know, is this a correct English wording? Yes? When I say a subject, a theme, I could also say a theme, would that make sense? Apparently, not everybody is clear what that means, to read a subject or a theme instead of reading a sentence. Who has difficulty in understanding what we want to do? And tell me what is the difficulty so that we can clear it up?
I think the problem is the proper emphasis, and when you are reading it, you give it the proper emphasis and it becomes simple.
I think that's the key to interpretation, to give proper emphasis. The question is, how do we give proper emphasis? I mean, would you have... So that's one answer. Would you have felt now, as what we were doing today in reading, did you feel somewhere helped for the future interpretation, how to read it? Or did I present it so that I just was putting the emphasis on something I want to put on it and then try to prove something that I want to prove? Yes?
I find if I read out loud, it helps me in my answer.
Yes? So you read it out for yourself and then you found a nice layout in the... Yes? I think it does, I would say, yes, if one emphasizes properly. Yes?
To read, say, a paragraph and then go over it and try and write an epitome before we find the tones and then look at our whole list of epitomes and see what actually happened in like a shorter version of the story. Does that help you?
Yes. I think... That's, I would say, how I worked, or perhaps would say worked in the past, because today practically everything in the textbook is already interpreted and laid out. I think, see, what you have to do is use the method of approximation. What does that mean, the method of approximation? Don't ever feel that on the first go you should be able to have the right interpretation. It is, as you say, you try it first, and then you begin to correct it and to polish it, and so on, until finally you have a satisfactory answer. So you go the way of approximation. How do we do that? I think what you said is a good method, a method that I used always, that I would say that I would read one paragraph, for instance, and therefore ask, now what is the theme of that paragraph? Not what does an individual word or sentence say, but can I see in it the theme? The theme is there something in it which was not in the preceding paragraph, which is an additional information? Then I would take that as a tentative result. I make a short epitome for myself on a piece of paper and just in a few words put it down. You don't need to make a true sentence. You just can put it down in just single few words. Then, when you go along and you finally have, say, done the whole subject, say, here, the answer to a question, then you look over what you have found, what you have found in each paragraph. And then suddenly you will find that perhaps in some successive paragraphs you have more or less the same answer. Then you know that these paragraphs belong together to one subject, to one theme. Just like we will have it right now when we go on. When we come now to the tone of truth, you will see that we have one, two, three, four paragraphs, and you will see that they all have somehow a common denominator, so that you suddenly feel, oh, these four paragraphs belong together, and they just bring out the same theme, like truth. And so you do that and polish it. Then you ask another question, namely, now, do my findings have really a common denominator as the answer to that question? Do they all answer, do my epitomes all answer the question here, do the five corporeal senses constitute man? Or have I given answers that have nothing to do with that? If I have given answers that have nothing to do with that, I know I have misread it, that I have misinterpreted it. Because they all must have come out of one mold. Do you know what I mean? One mold, Is that the right term? Yes?
What if it's a subject that doesn't ask the questions? What if it's from a chapter that's not recapitulation that asks the questions?
Yeah. Then you have longer chapters, and you have even more difficulties, because it becomes more and more difficult. Then you must take recourse to my summer school I once had here for a whole week on text interpretation. That's a lot.
Is there usually a dominant tone at the beginning?
No, you cannot rely on that. Now, it can be like we have seen here, that sometimes a subtone is right stated in the first sentence. Sometimes the subject is only stated in the last sentence of the paragraph. Now, you can't rely on that. See? So you have to rely on asking what is the theme. You can't rely on anything else. You must ask, what is she talking here? What is the subject? What is your party talk? What were they talking at the party? Oh, they were talking about the holiday. You must ask about the subject. Yes?
How much measures do you take from God's known headings?
I take them and take them not. This is the marginal headings. Can be very sidetracking. Sometimes they are right to the point, sometimes they are sidetracking. Why? Because they may indicate the main tone. They may also indicate the subtone. So you can be sidetracking. Say you have a subject of life in seven subtones. Let's say that. So, perhaps you are in life as soul, and the marginal heading may be something about life, not about soul. So that you feel, oh, I'm in life, and not in the subtone of soul. So, the marginal headings are rather difficult. I wouldn't take them as too much a guide. You can't, because you have too many subtones.
Who did Betty write the marginal headings? I was going to be.
Well, there is a great discussion going on about that, if she or Wiggins has written them, and naturally the authorities in Boston, I think they all say it's Mrs. Eddy that wrote them.
That's why I'm asking. They say she did not write.
Yes, well, do they say that? Do you have any?
We have a letter for everyone.
Yes?
And they only tried to edit wrote a letter to my husband. He had
yes.
Given her an article and he had used marginal headings, and she said that you couldn't do that because Mrs. Eddy did not write the marginal headings. And that's the first I ever heard that.
Would be interesting to have that the copy of that letter. Yes. Because usually I think Peel says that it is naturally from her and not from Wiggins. So, I don't know. I haven't been there.
Maybe they argue about it too.
Yes. But I would say the marginal headings are the things that in the whole textbook that, well, how do you say that in English? That are, the well, at the difficult things, that they are tricky in the for interpretation. Sometimes you just wonder why that marginal heading is there. And also you can see something else you have to be aware, that sometimes she makes a marginal heading that does not only apply to that paragraph, but to the succeeding paragraphs, and that the main point come only out in the succeeding paragraphs which have no marginal headings. So I would say the marginal heading is the only tricky thing I found in the textbook. But that's, I may be all wrong and so on. So I can't be a greater help for that. But the text seems to be always very straightforward. Well, all right. So we go on to the subject of truth. Perhaps right here we can see how we have to be careful to hear the theme. See, she says here, sleep and mesmerism explain the mythical nature of material sense. Now, that's quite new. Now she begins to explain what actually material sense is at that as belief, and does not just say it's a mortal belief, as she has said in the tone of mind. Now she brings in sleep and mesmerism, and we'll see if we listen that she is speaking now over a page and a half always about that whole sense of sleep and dreams and unconsciousness and consciousness, all that state of consciousness, sleep consciousness, and so on. Write the next sentence. Sleep shows material sense as either oblivion, that's a nice part, when you don't know anything, not even dream, nothingness, or an illusion, or dream. Can you hear right away now? She takes up the sense of consciousness, that the material senses are actually only a state of consciousness, and that according to the sleep and so on, you have them, you don't notice the material senses. If you are fast asleep, we have not even a knowledge of the material senses. If we are dreaming, we have a consciousness of material senses, but they are again different. In the sleep, we also can suffer, we can also enjoy. In sleep, we also can hear, We also can see, as if the corporeal senses would suddenly be here again, but now as a state of consciousness. So she really reduces those five physical senses always more and more to a sense of consciousness. Under the mesmeric illusion, you have again the mesmeric illusion, hypnotic illusion, sleep illusion, dream illusion of belief, a man will think that he is freezing when he is warm. Can you see the material senses? Can you see, do actually the material senses constitute man? When he is actually freezing, when he is hot. Can you see how contradictory the five physical senses become? Is that clear? That they are not the truth teller, that they can tell the very opposite of what they really should testify. They testify to cold when they are warm, and that he is swimming when he is on dry land. We lie in the bed on dry land, and then we dream that we are swimming. How on earth can we do that? How reliable are these testimony of the physical senses? Needle thrusts will not hurt him. See, these are all examples. The examples bring no further information. That's one thing that you always have to remember. Never draw any conclusion from an example. Always draw the conclusion from that about which you have examples. These are all examples. A delicious perfume will seem intolerable. Again, another example. Actually, we could cut them out. They are examples. Animal magnetism thus uncovers material sense and shows it to be a belief without actual foundation or validity, valueless. So here we can see that she goes one step further than in mind, where she just said that five corporeal senses are a mortal belief. Now she says they are without value. They have no validity because they are not true. They tell the very opposite of what is true, of what is happening, the very opposite. So they are without validity. Change the belief and the sensation changes. See, you could have said, well, change in my list of ideas has to do with soul, so this must be soul. But that is not really under consideration as a main theme here. As a main theme here is that it is always the belief that determines our sensation. So if we change one from one belief to the other belief, we naturally change the sensation. Destroy the belief. That's interesting. Destroy the belief and the sensation disappears. For the very first time, she takes in that true sense of destroy that belief. Destroy that sleep belief, that mesmeric belief, that dream belief. Destroy it and then sensation will disappear. So we have a sense here of the validity of the testament of the five physical senses. And we just go on. I come to the next paragraph. Material man is made up of involuntary and voluntary error, of a negative right and a positive wrong, the latter calling itself right. It's all one muddle up. Huh? What is right is wrong, what is wrong is right. You can see, like before, that the testimony of the material sense cannot be believed. But you see, she takes up another kind of mesmeric belief. Huh? Not before we had sleep, and then again sleep, and then dream, then animal magnetism. And now we have voluntary and involuntary error. Well, what is involuntary error? See, and voluntary error. It's again showing a realm of involuntary error, which says you do things and you experience things without that you want it. That it is that there is another strata of consciousness at work on which you have no dominion, and it just handles you the way that involuntary error handles you. You are just a cork on the wave, thrown through and forth. Man's spiritual individuality is never wrong. Now, you have a positive sense for the first time in this tone of truth. As he says, but man's spiritual individuality is never wrong. So what constitutes man? That man is never wrong. He's always at the point of truth. Why? It is the likeness of man's maker. Can you see now? She lifts it right out of the dream sense, the mesmeric sense, and voluntary error and involuntary error, and lifts it out into God and says, man is God's likeness. Matter cannot connect mortals with the true origin and facts of being. Now you have the true origin, the facts of being, all is truth, in which all must end. It is only by acknowledging the supremacy of spirit, not what has been shown as that dream stuff, which annuls the claims of matter, that mortals can lay off mortality and find the indissoluble spiritual link which establishes man forever in the divine likeness, inseparable from the Creator. Can you see the whole paragraph has an accent on the positive answer now? What constitutes man? It's not error that constitutes man, not involuntary error, nor voluntary error that constitutes man. What is it? And now she gives the sense of the sixth day of creation. It is actually that man is God's likeness. That constitutes man. And that's the standpoint we have to know. And that's the standpoint we have to acknowledge. And that establishes the indissoluble spiritual link, which establishes man forever in the divine likeness. You see, is man the likeness of our dream stuff, or of our sleep stuff, or of the mesmeric stuff? Is he that? And the answer he gives, no. The sixth day says, man is the likeness of God, the image and likeness of God. That's his consciousness. That constitutes man. You see, then, again, when we go on, how, therefore, she says we should awake out of that dream in order to arrive at that which constitutes the true man. The next paragraph reads, the belief that matter and mind are one. What does it mean? The belief that matter and mind are one. What do we have when matter and mind is one? The five physical senses, huh? Mind and matter. When they mix up, we have sensation. So the belief that matter and mind are one, that matter is awake, can you see again, awake at one time and asleep at another, sometimes presenting no appearance of mind at all, this belief culminates in another belief that man dies. So, again, we have the tone of sleep, a sleeping state, a waking out of the sleep, not to rest asleep, and get out of that. Science reveals material man as never the real being. Why? The dream or belief goes on. The dream or belief goes on. Can you hear that again, dream? Did we have in the first five tones a dream? Did we have in the first time tone sleep? Did we have in the first five tones mesmeric action? Did we have a voluntary error? Did we have all those kinds of consciousness straighters? No. Huh? Here, where she has to really to show that really man is God's consciousness of himself, she has to show that the corporeal senses are dream stuff, are sleep stuff. There, we only have to change the dream and we dream something else and the five corporeal senses testify to something else. So, line 22, the dream or belief goes on, whether our eyes are closed or open. In sleep, memory and consciousness are lost from the body, and they wander whither they will, apparently with their own separate embodiment. Again, you have a sense, it's all dream stuff. And in the dream stuff, the corporeal senses become wild with freedom. They just wander wherever they want. They can show us all kinds of things. We can either open our eyes or close our eyes, and then we just can imagine anything we like to imagine. Then our so-called dream senses just show a beautiful landscape. You can dream of the most powerful, big waterfall, much bigger than you have in America, than any country has. We can't do that. Can we do that? We just can sit right now and figure out in our awake state, if you like, the most terrific waterfalls. Can't you do that? Just see a terrific mountain about 15,000 meters high. What's that? About 40 feet high. And just a terrific waterfall just running down over the whole thing. Isn't it beautiful? Huh? Just can see that. And we can see with our eyes, so to say, the whole water coming down, how it goes over some rocks and how it gushes all over the place, and how down there, you see there are standing a few people watching the wonderful sight. And so can't you see it? Very easy. See, you can see it with your, well, what sees? Do the five physical senses see? You say, no, that's your dream stuff. What you see is your dream stuff. It's not the truth.